This is Lorraine bringing it to you, reading Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear by Elizabeth Gilbert. Part 5, Trust. Part 3, Stubborn Gladness. All I can tell you for certain is that my entire life has been shaped by an early decision to reject the cult of artistic martyrdom, and instead to place my trust in the crazy notion that my work loves me as much as I love it, that it wants to play with me as much as I want to play with it, and that this source of love and play is boundless. I have chosen to believe that a desire to be creative was encoded into my DNA for reasons I will never know, and that creativity will not go away from me unless I forcibly kick it away or poison it dead. Every molecule of my being has always pointed me toward this line of work, toward language, storytelling, research, narrative. If destiny didn't want me to be a writer, I figured, then it shouldn't have made me one. But it did make me one, and I decided to meet that destiny with as much good cheer and as little drama as I can. Because how I choose to handle myself as a writer is entirely my own choice. I can make my creativity into a killing field, or I can make it into a really interesting cabinet of curiosities. I can even make it into an act of prayer. My ultimate choice, then, is to always approach my work from a place of stubborn gladness. I worked for years with stubborn gladness before I was published. I worked with stubborn gladness when I was still an unknown new writer, whose first book sold just a handful of copies, mostly to members of my own family. I worked with stubborn gladness when I was riding high on a giant bestseller. I worked with stubborn gladness when I was not riding high on a giant bestseller anymore, and when my subsequent books did not sell millions of copies. I worked with stubborn gladness when critics praised me, and I worked with stubborn gladness when critics made fun of me. I've held to my stubborn gladness when my work is going badly, and also when it's going well. I don't ever choose to believe that I've been completely abandoned in the creative wilderness, or that there's reason for me to panic about my writing. I choose to trust that inspiration is always nearby the whole time I'm working, trying its damnedest to impart assistance. It's just that inspiration comes from another world, you see, and it speaks a language entirely unlike my own. So sometimes we have trouble understanding each other, but inspiration is still sitting there right beside me, and it is trying. Inspiration is trying to send me messages in every form it can. Through drama, through portraits, through clues, through coincidences, through deja vu, through kismet, through surprising waves of attraction and reaction, through the chills that run up my arms, through the hair that stands up on the back of my neck, through the pleasure of something new and surprising, through stubborn ideas that keep me awake all night long. Whatever works. Inspiration is always trying to work with me. So I sit there and I work too. That's the deal. I trust it. It trusts me. Choose your delusion. Is this delusional? Is it delusional of me to place infinite trust in a force that I cannot see, touch, or prove? A force that might not even actually exist. Okay. For the sake of argument, let's call it totally delusional. But is it any more delusional than believing that only your suffering and your pain are authentic, or that you are alone, that you have no relationship whatsoever with the universe that created you, or that you have been singled out by destiny, especially cursed, or that your talents were given to you for the mere purpose of destroying you? What I'm saying is this. If you're going to live your life based on delusion, and you are, because we all do, then why not at least select a delusion that is healthy? Allow me to suggest this one. The work wants to be made, and it wants to be made through you. The martyr versus the trickster. But in order to let go of the addiction to creative suffering, you must reject the way of the martyr and embrace the way of the trickster. We all have a bit of trickster in us, and we all have a bit of martyr in us. Okay, some of us have a lot of martyr in us. But at some point in your creative journey, you will have to make a decision about which camp you wish to belong to, and therefore which parts of yourself to nourish, cultivate, and bring into being. Choose carefully. As my friend, the radio personality, Carolyn Casey, always says, better a trickster than a martyr be. What's the difference between a martyr and a trickster, you may ask? Here's a quick primer. Martyr energy is dark, solemn, macho, hierarchical, fundamentalist, austere, unforgiving, and profoundly rigid. Trickster energy is light, sly, transgender, transgressive, animus, seditious, primal, and endlessly shape-shifting. Martyr says, I will sacrifice everything to fight this unwinnable war, even if it means being crushed to death under a wheel of torment. Trickster says, okay, you enjoy that. As for me, I'll be over here in this corner, running a successful little black market operation on the side of your unwinnable war. Martyr says, life is pain. Trickster says, life is interesting. Martyr says, the system is rigged against all that is good and sacred. Trickster says, there is no system. Everything is good and nothing is sacred. Martyr says, nobody will ever understand me. Trickster says, pick a card, any card. Martyr says, the world can never be solved. Trickster says, perhaps not, but it can be gained. Martyr says, through my torment, the truth shall be revealed. Trickster says, I didn't come here to suffer, pal. Martyr says, death before dishonor. Trickster says, let's make a deal. Martyr always ends up dead in a heap of broken glory, while trickster trots off to enjoy another day. Martyr equals Sir Thomas More. Trickster equals Bugs Bunny. Trickster trust. I believe that the original human impulse for creativity was born out of pure trickster energy. Of course it was. Creativity wants to flip the mundane world upside down and turn it inside out. And that's exactly what a trickster does best. But somewhere in the last few centuries, creativity got kidnapped by the martyrs and has been held hostage in their camp of suffering ever since. I believe this turn of events has left art feeling very sad. It's definitely left a lot of artists feeling very sad. It's time to give creativity back to the tricksters, is what I say. The trickster is obviously a charming and subversive figure, but for me, the most wonderful thing about a good trickster is that he trusts. It may seem counterintuitive to suggest this because he can seem so slippery and shady, but the trickster is full of trust. He trusts himself, obviously. He trusts his own cunning, his own right to be here, his own ability to land on his feet in any situation. To a certain extent, of course, he also trusts other people, in that he trusts them to be marks for his shrewdness, but mostly the trickster trusts the universe. He trusts in its chaotic, lawless, ever fascinating ways, and for this reason, he does not suffer from undue anxiety. He trusts that the universe is in constant play, and specifically that it wants to play with him. A good trickster knows that if he cheerfully tosses a ball out into the cosmos, that ball will be thrown back at him. It might be thrown back really hard, or it might be thrown back really crooked, or it might be thrown back in a cartoonish hail of missiles, or it might not be thrown back until the middle of next year. But that ball will eventually be thrown back. The trickster waits for the ball to return, catches it however it arrives, and then tosses it back out there into the void again, just to see what will happen. And he loves doing it because the trickster, in all his cleverness, understands the one great cosmic truth that the mortal, in all his seriousness, can never grasp. It's all just a game, a big, freaky, wonderful game, which is fine because the trickster likes freaky. Freaky is his natural environment. The martyr hates freaky. The martyr wants to kill freaky, and in so doing, he all too often ends up killing himself. A good trickster move. I'm friends with Brené Brown, the author of Daring Greatly, and other works on human vulnerability. Brené writes wonderful books, but they don't come easily for her. She sweats and struggles and suffers throughout the writing process and always has. But recently, I introduced Brené to this idea that creativity is for tricksters, not for martyrs. It was an idea she'd never heard before. As Brené explained, "Hey, I come from a background in academia, which is deeply entrenched in martyrdom, as in, you must labor and suffer for years in solitude to produce work that only four people will ever read." But when Brené latched on to this idea of tricksterdom, she took a closer look at her own work habits and realized she had been creating from far too dark and heavy a place within herself. She had already written several successful books, for all of them had been like a medieval road of trials for her, nothing but fear and anguish throughout the entire writing process. She'd never questioned any of this anguish because she'd assumed it was all perfectly normal. After all, serious artists can only prove their merit through serious pain. Like so many creators before her, she had come to trust in their pain above all. But when she tuned in to the possibility of writing from a place of trickster energy, she had a breakthrough. She realized that the act of writing itself was indeed genuinely difficult for her, but that storytelling was not. Brené is a captivating storyteller, and she loves public speaking. She's a fourth-generation Texan who can string a tale like nobody's business. She knew that when she spoke her ideas aloud, they flowed like a river. But when she tried to write those ideas down, they cramped up on her. Then she figured out how to trick the process. For her last book, Brené tried something new, a super cunning trickster move of the highest order. She enlisted two trusted colleagues to join her at a beach house in Galveston to help her finish her book, which was under serious deadline. She asked them to sit there on the couch and take detailed notes while she told them stories about the subject of her book. After each story, she would grab their notes, run into the other room, shut the door, and write down exactly what she had just told them, while they waited patiently in the living room. Thus, Brené was able to capture the natural tone of her own speaking voice on the page, much the way the poet Ruth Stone figured out how to capture poems as they moved through her. Then Brene would dash back into the living room and read aloud what she had just written. Her colleagues would help her to tease out the narrative even further by asking her to explain herself with new anecdotes and stories, as again they took notes. And again, Brene would grab those notes and go transcribe the story. By setting a trickster trap for her own storytelling, Brene figured out how to catch her own tiger by the tail. Much laughter and absurdity were involved in this process. They were, after all, just three girlfriends alone at a beach house. There were taco runs and visits to the Gulf. They had a blast. This scene is pretty much the exact opposite of the stereotypical image of the tormented artist sweating it out all alone in this great studio. But as Brene told me, I'm done with all that. Never again will I write about the subject of human connection while suffering in isolation. And her new trick worked like a charm. Never had Brene written faster. Never had she written better. Never had she written with such trust. Mind you, this was not a book of comedy that she was writing either. A light-hearted process does not necessarily need to result in a light-hearted product. Brene is a renowned sociologist who studies shame, after all. This was a book about vulnerability, failure, anxiety, despair, and hard-earned emotional resilience. Her book came out on the page just as deep and serious as it needed to be. It's just that she had a good time writing it because she finally figured out how to game the system. In so doing, she finally accessed her own abundant source of big magic. That's how a trickster gets the job done. Lightly, lightly, ever lightly. This is Lorraine bringing it to you, reading Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear by Elizabeth Gilbert, Part 5, Trust, Part 3. Stay tuned for Part 4.